Okay, so we're back here with side B. Now you mentioned that fellow who must have had a premonition gave away his personal effects, and that, you know, he considered him a candidate for the Flack House, and well, here it comes to pass, he actually happened to be the guy that bought the farm, as they say. To what extent did you notice crewmen getting sent to the so-called Flack House, the R&R center where, you know, battle fatigue personnel could just take a time out?
Well, the first mission that we were on, the one of the crews that came over, that we'd gone through all the training with in the States, the first mission radio operator went berserk. And that was on the mission of Rames, and he went to the hospital and they sent him back home. But as far as I know, that's the only one that, you know, I'm aware of. You know, crews were coming and going, and, you know, either lost or something like that. I really don't remember too many of them going to R&R.
So, and when you say when that guy went berserk, did he do anything to jeopardize his crew?
Oh, he tore up the radio compartment. I mean, he just, you know, there wasn't any, you know, it was, I guess your first mission is scary, but, you know, really you look back on it and it wasn't that bad, but you just couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's no disrespect to him.
Mm.
You just,
so, you of course knew that there was this Flack House possibility that anyone who needed a timeout, but you didn't see too many people
get sent off to that.
I see.
Well, I think it was kind of a pride thing too. I think you didn't want to admit, you know, I mean, it's getting to me, you know, I think you wanted to get your missions in and you didn't want to let your crew down, and, you know, you just stuck with it.
Now, one thing I was also kind of wondering about was, If you would get shot down, how you felt about your prospects for treatment in the German, you know, the Stahlagluft, whatever, did you have any reports or any concern that the local Germans or, of course it depends, if you're shot down over occupied France, you might have a better feel for how the locals might treat you, but how did you view the differences between being shot down?
Well, we really didn't think about it because, you know, we didn't have any feedback, you know, about the underground, you know, bringing people back. We had our escape kit, and you just never thought about it. I guess if that happened, you'd just probably wait until that fatal moment, you know, and then do what you wanted to do or had to do. But we really never thought about it that much.
No feedback on the underground or the POW camps,
no.
Really? Okay. You mentioned the escape kit. What was in there?
Oh, golly. I think we had some German money. We had a little compass. We had a map. I think we had some candy bars or, you know, just a water purification tablets, you know, just the basic stuff, you know, to kind of keep us going until we got our senses and, you know, figured out what to do after that.
Nothing better than nothing,
yeah.
And give you a little more confidence, yeah, if you needed it. now, also, I'm wondering to what extent, you know, with all the concerns about fighters, flak, and that, to what extent did you notice non-combat losses, where weather, you know, were trying to get the formation together, maybe in the fog
or
something?
Well, weather was bad. I mean, if you had to form up in the overcast, you know, everybody had to fly at a certain compass heading, certain rate of climb and all that stuff. And I'm surprised there weren't more mid-air collisions than there were, because you could always tell when there was one because, you know, a great big section of the sky would light up, you know, where two of them came together. We just about got it on one mission. The plane came out of nowhere. And I mean, if it hadn't been a split section action on the pilot, you know, we would have gotten it because, see, though there were bomber bases all over England. And then another thing I think that was dangerous too was when a new crew would go on a mission. And we had one experience where a waste gunner, we were under fire attack, and he put a string of 50 caliber bullets right through our plane. He didn't let off, and our left waste gunner, he was going to shoot that plane down. I mean, boy, they had to pull him away from the guns because he's going to take that one out.
And lucky nobody on the plane got hit.
Nobody got hurt, but boy, there was
he really laced it.
He You could have put a needle and thread and done a nice sewing job on what he did. He just got carried away. And Smitty, that was a waist gunner. He was pretty mild mannered, but boy, the other waist gunner had to pull him away from the gunner. He would have taken that one out of the air, I'm sure.
Well, now you said you just about had a mid-air collision yourself. Do you remember that? Did you have any awareness that that was about to happen?
No, the first thing I saw was a plane coming in just right out right on the tail. And I hollered for the pilot to dump it. And we went down, and I don't know how close he came. I mean, it was scary.
Well, let me understand. So you saw this plane coming up at you from the rear, and you hollered to
no,
the
No, he was coming up. See, he was coming towards us. And I don't, and I...
Coming
I,
towards you head on, or...
No, he was coming towards the tail.
He was coming, and you saw him coming?
Yeah, I just had boomed, I hollered, dump it. And evidently, Lieutenant Poole knew what I meant, because, boy, he was... And I don't...
Dump it means get low, or yeah, get drop your altitude.
Yeah, get right. It down in a hurry. And I don't know how close he came, but...
And he flew right over the top of you or something?
He went right over the top of the rudder, yeah. Hmm. And even the waist gunner, the radio operator, saw it. And the nose, when they saw him go over, you know, I mean, it just happened so fast, you know why. And it was just
so was the crew, did the crew say, hey, thanks to you, thanks for you quickly alerting
well,
us?
Well, I guess so, yeah. I just, you know, you boy, boom, and it was gone.
Well, I imagine, what, 9 other guys probably owed you a big thank
yeah,
you,
well,
right?
I don't know. I just, but he just came out of nowhere. I mean.
Well, and I imagine, it's my understanding, the B-17 had 10 crew members on board, so you generally always had 10 on board, right? Did you ever have anybody fly along for whatever reason, a cameraman the flight surgeon might want to go up?
Yeah, not on our plane. They might have in another plane, but we just flew with our standard crew.
I see. And, of course, the B-17 is quite legendary in terms of its ability to withstand punishment. What would you say to that?
I would say that's correct. And I've seen some of them come home tattered and torn. Some of them have been in such bad shape that the engineers say that they can't fly. But, you know, somehow they managed to bring it back, and they could really take a beating.
Well, was there any mission where you found your own aircraft that you had to, you know, feather engines or whatever?
Yeah, we had to feather an engine. I don't know how many times. Not the normal, but, you know, it happened just enough to really, really get your attention. We come home with a pretty good sized hole in the wing, or peppered, you know, pretty well perforated sometimes. And
so you had to feather an engine. Well, out of the 11 missions you went on, you had that.
I probably imagine we probably lost maybe about 4 times. Maybe they either took a flak hit, or maybe, you know, the prop ran away, or, you know, some malfunction on the engine or something like that.
And then was your aircraft always repairable?
Oh yeah.
What was the nose art on your aircraft?
Lady Lillian.
Lady Lillian.
Yeah. Just the name. It wasn't any picture. That was the pilot's wife.
Wife. And there was no painting of the name.
Yeah.
And no scantily clad.
No. Boy, no.
And that was, did you always fly that same aircraft on each mission?
Not all the time, because sometimes it might be in for an inspection, or maybe sometimes it might be in for repair, you know, if we flew a mission back-to-back and, you know, it was undergoing repair, we would be assigned to another one, and you didn't like that.
Mm, you like to stay on the same
one. You like to stay on the only one, you know, that you're familiar with and everything, so.
Now, is serving as the tail gunner, did you, to what extent did you or other crew members get credit or partial credit for hitting German aircraft?
None.
A lot of bullets fired.
A lot of bullets, and you know, if everybody's claims would have been honored, the Luftwaffe would have been decimated by Thanksgiving. If you were a straggler, then probably you could, you know, if you had somebody witness, you know, but, you know, it was, we didn't even put in claims, you know. We did maybe our first one or two missions, and then we just saw, you know, what does it matter? I mean, all it does is get you one towards an air metal or something like that, and with all the bullets flying out, you know, I mean, it's pretty hard to do that.
Well, so you've just, with all the bullets flying and everybody shooting, it's pretty hard to sort out who's...
who did it, yeah.
Did you see any aircraft, any German aircraft get hit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'd see them hit, and we'd see them, you know, go over on their back or maybe go down in smoke, you know, I mean, go down straight down.
Mm-hmm.
And I very seldom ever saw a shoot over, you know, because they were probably going so fast and we were going away from the action, too. Saw a lot of 17s go down, you know, that was kind of common. But German aircraft, no, I mean, it...
And then, when you saw a 17 go down, the crews would always try and watch and count shoots?
Yeah,
and
we'd
see.
Count the shoots and see how many would go out, and of course everybody was doing that, and you're hoping and praying you'd see 10, and sometimes you didn't have a chance, and it would blow up right, boom, like that, and they were gone.
To what extent did B-17s tend to blow up without giving much chance to get out, or was that fairly infrequent?
Well, that just depended upon where you got hit.
Yeah.
You know, if you got hit in, the fuselage, bomb bay, or where the wing rushing of the bomb bay, I mean, it was all over with. A lot of times, if you had a wing fire, you know, you might have a chance to bail out unless it was so hot, you know, that a wing fell off or something like that. So it was it just depended upon where you took your hits.
Well, now tell me about your typical day. In other words, that is a day when you would fly a mission, roughly, and I know there were variations, you know, how long a mission might be, all that sort of thing, but for most of those missions, when you typically got up, got your chow, went off to briefing, kicked the props and that sort of thing, and then you fly the mission and then you come back for your debriefing, could you try and go over the flow of a day?
Well, if they'd wake us up, you know, in the morning, if we were scheduled to fly, that'd probably be, depending upon the mission, maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, we'd get dressed and...
Now, you would know the night before that you had a mission?
Well, we knew somebody was going to fly. The base was on alert, but we didn't know...
By crew, you didn't know?
No, we didn't know until they...
They didn't even tell you by crew. I mean, of course, they're not going to tell you the target location and all that ahead of time, or, you know, the night before, but... They didn't. It was a crapshoot. You didn't know who was actually going to be flying.
You didn't know who was until they opened the barracks door and hollered, Poland's crew, and then they'd reel off their names. And,
oh, really? And so, I imagine that didn't feel too good.
No,
it didn't. That every morning it was a crapshoot. Who's going to actually have to go? And then, of course, when you get to the briefing, you find out where you're going to go and whether or not that's even worse news. So, okay, I'm sorry,
well,
I'm interrupting you.
Yeah,
I just wasn't sure if you knew the night before.
No, we didn't know until they come in there with that doggone flashlight and wake you up. And then we'd get dressed, and always shaved, because, you know, you wanted a good tight fit on your oxygen mask. And then we'd go to the mess hall for the powdered eggs and Spam, you know, and then we had to be at the briefing at a certain time. And... that was a happy time. I mean, everybody was talking and jabbering until they pulled the curtains aside. And then a lot of time, it got real serious.
Well, let me understand here. So you say, you know, you're up 3:30 or 4 very often, and then you shave and you go off to breakfast, and so you're starting to brief maybe what time?
Well, that depended upon takeoff time. Maybe sometimes around 5:30, 6, 6:30, somewhere around in there. You know, depending upon the target, you know, how much, you know, how long we had to be in the air and everything like that, and the weather.
And then how soon after the briefing would take usually how long?
Well, they'd brief all the crews together, and then the pilots and navigators and bombardiers had separate briefings. The whole crew briefing would probably take maybe 20 minutes, maybe 20, 25 minutes.
Typically, okay.
Yeah, maybe.
And you said the bomb navs, or the bombardiers and the navigators and the pilots, they each had separate...
Yeah, that's where they went over their courses, you know, they had to set their watches up.
Is that to say all three types of positions were in one briefing, or
the bombardiers
were in one,
went to one,
navigators to another,
and then
pilots
the pilot
to
co-pilot went to another one, yeah.
Okay.
And they got information, no particular, you know, comment. I mean, that they had to know, you know, with it.
And so after the briefings were done, what would you normally be taking off within an hour or 2 hours?
Probably maybe an hour and a half. I mean, we had to get out our flight gear and then take the trucks out, you know, to where the aircraft was, and went through the pre-flight, you know, being sure everything was checked out and checked your guns, ammunition. And, that was probably the worst part of the mission was before you took off. I mean, you know, the apprehension, you're wondering whether you're going to make it back or what's going to happen.
Was there, well, of course, we've talked about the Schweinfurt mission some, where that became such a legendary mission with terrible losses. And you mentioned, you know, the pulling of the curtains was quite a dramatic moment. Was there any time you noticed where they pulled the curtains and told you a target and people just about dropped their jaw?
No.
What ones would you say rank up there as
Bremen?
Bremen. That was.
That was Flak Valley. That was down in the Ruhr Valley. That was the one that
people dreaded, really.
No.
And the day you went to Schweinfurt for that terribly famous mission, did it really dawn on many people that that might be a rough go?
No, they told us it would be rough, but we were concerned about the length. You know, the entire crews were briefed if you got in trouble, go over the Alps, you know, and hit neutral territory. But no, nobody had any idea, you know, that it was going to be that, you know, that kind of a disaster. But on the same token, you know, about, I forget when it was in October, we were briefed to hit Berlin, which would have been a complete disaster because we didn't have fighter escort. It would have been touch and go on the range, you know, as far as fuel supplies. And but everybody was really, we were uptight about that one. And they canceled it before we got airborne. I mean, somebody must have gotten wise or something. But Bremen, that probably drew the most comments and raspberries and stuff like that when they pulled the curtain apart.
Any others that come to mind where people just said, oh shit, or whatever?
Well, you always had a little bit of comment, you know, but Bremen usually drew the...
That was the one. Yeah. Now, okay, and then we said how the missions varied in duration. And then when you got back, what, everybody participated in the debrief? Typically?
Yeah, all crews had to go into debriefing, and that probably took, you know, depending upon how bad the action was, you know, maybe that took maybe half hour, 45 minutes. And then you turn in your flight gear and you're on your own. You head over to the mess hall, and the mess hall was always open for the flight crews. You know, we always had something to eat when we got back.
So a half hour to 45 minutes if there were things to, you know, go over.
Yeah.
Then, so what would you say in your experience with your 11 missions, were you actually flying combat every, well, X number of days? How often would you say it turned out for you?
Well, some days you'd go maybe a week without flying because of the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you might fly missions back to back, you know.
You mean one day and then the next?
Yeah. Yeah. And then also they were getting enough aircraft in, you know, that maybe the group flew missions that you didn't fly. You know, you weren't scheduled to fly, you know, that was your day off.
So you mentioned how they would come in the morning and say, hey, so-and-so's crew, up and at 'em. And so what, when you'd hear somebody going around to the different barracks, and then the only way you knew you weren't going, or would somebody pop their head in the door and say, hey, so-and-so's crew, you're off the hook today?
No.
It was just a matter of you figured it out because they never bothered to call.
Well, we had our names on the end of our bunks.
Yeah.
And he would go by a flashlight and he would kick each bed. You know, I mean, you're flying today.
Well, but it was by crew, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, by crew,
it
yeah.
Was by crew.
And those that weren't flying, you know, they'd get woke up and they'd probably go back to sleep, you know. Probably be happy that they didn't have to go.
Well, in a given barracks, you would have, what, enough guys from how many crews in a given barracks?
We probably had, I imagine, about 8 crews.
To a barracks?
And to a barracks, probably.
So that's where, within a barracks, you might have so many of them being tapped to go on today's mission.
Maybe 2 crews might.
But because they're going around, it quickly becomes apparent who's been tapped to go and who got skipped over. And did you notice any method to that madness of how people were assigned to fly on a given day?
No, I don't know how it was. I don't know how they decided who was going to go what mission. I think they usually took your top pilots, your top crews, you know, to fly lead and deputy lead. You know, that really had their heads on right, knew what they were doing.
Mm. Now, of course, with your 11th mission, and I don't want to, you know, bring up things that you might not want to go into much detail on, but obviously the 11th mission was your last mission, and it involved serious injury to you that required lengthy hospitalization. So I'm wondering to what extent you'd want to describe what happened on that mission, and not, of course, what you to the target, what happened with your aircraft, and then what happened with you in particular, and how it.
Well, we were on the bomb run.
And to what target was that?
To Bremen.
That was to Bremen.
And the last thing I remember was a noise that sounded like it took a bunch of coal cinders and threw them in a garbage can and shook them. I mean, that's my last recollection of the war. I mean, just like somebody took a GI can with bricks or hunks of concrete and dropped it on the floor. That's the last thing I remember.
And now this was the 11th mission to Bremen. You were over Bremen at the
well,
time?
Well, I don't know how close we were to the target, but we were on the bomb run.
On the bomb run.
Yeah, and flak got us.
And a big flak burst.
Yeah.
And you heard this tremendous noise. And so what happened? How close was the burst?
I have no idea. It was close enough to get me.
Well, so you got peppered with flak.
Yeah.
How many pieces would you say?
Well, the tail was pretty well mutilated. I think they took out, see, I had one under my eye. I got lucky on that. I had probably about 8 or 9.
8 or 9 pieces of flak in you.
This is kind of gruesome. I hate to, when they put me in the hospital, they built a frame over me. So nothing would touch me. You know, something like a tent, you know, and then they put sheets over that. I guess I was a mess. I mean, because I froze both my hands and feet.
Although I see today, you know, your hands got frozen at altitude, of course, and feet, but apparently without the loss of any fingers or toes.
I was awfully close to it, but no, evidently when they pulled me out, of course the heated suit wasn't working, and I'd taken off my gloves, which was I don't know, in my state of unconsciousness I must have been doing something. I mean, I wonder, I don't know.
Your heated suit didn't work?
Well, it was unplugged. Yeah, it probably went out when I got hit.
From what you've been able to piece together after the fact, so somebody, obviously they knew the back of the plane had gotten hit, and one of the crew members came back.
I think the radio operator and one of the waist gunners got me out, and of course, you know, with all your heavy flying gear and stuff like that, you know, it must have been a struggle. And I know they said they gave me morphine.
So the flak that hit you, you mentioned one went under the eye, and there were 8 or 9 pieces. Where else did you get hit?
I had some in my arm, I had some in my leg, you know, just kind of, I guess, scattered a little bit.
And all of which were removed during the war? They didn't leave any?
No.
And I think before we started our interview, you mentioned you even have one of the pieces today?
I've got a little piece that holds me about a little bit larger than a pea.
Would you say that was how did it come to pass that you got that particular piece?
I really don't know. I had that in the hospital at Oxford. I don't know how I happened. Maybe the doctor took it out and gave it to me. I mean, I really don't know.
Oh.
But it was in a little...
It wasn't like you were asking for
these pieces. I do remember he said that you might want this as a souvenir.
And did he say if that was the smallest one or the biggest one?
No,
or?
I...
Oh. And you still have that today at your house, huh? Well, that might make a museum someday or something, or a family heirloom of some sort.
It's not that an impressive a piece, you know. It just
So you got I believe you said the tail was pretty well mauled, and you got peppered pretty
yeah.
well, but did it leave any lasting impairment for you? I mean, I see, you know, you don't appear to have
oh,
any.
Oh, no, no, I came out fine. They, I was very close to having, being a, what do you call it, a quadra, you know, I was about 24 hours of having my feet and hands amputated.
Mm.
And I, boy, I convinced the doctors that I could feel something. You know, I was beginning to feel something, and they didn't believe me. And they blindfolded me, and evidently they took needles, and they touched different fingers, and I was able to tell them, you know, which ones they were. So I was saved on that.
So they really were testing you, and you passed the blindfold
yeah.
test. Otherwise, you might have lost your hands.
Oh, it was pathetic. I tell you, I don't know how they saved them, because it was. It was horrible. I mean, I just.
Now, were you married at this time?
No, no.
Not married yet. So, or sweetheart type thing at that point.
What?
Was there a certain sweetheart?
Oh yeah, well, I was the same young lady in the high school, my junior and senior years, and whenever I'd come home, you know, we'd date. And
the same girl that became.
Mm-hmm.
Your
became
partner
my wife,
in life,
yeah.
yeah. So I imagine there was quite a bit of concern that, you know, how are you going to pull through
yeah.
with these very
well,
serious
and
injuries?
And the information they got, didn't give any details at all.
Oh, the very cryptic telegram
yeah.
that I appreciate you still have that copy
yeah.
today, and I'll make a copy so that anyone can see. Well, actually, let me go ahead and just read it. It's so short here. Let me
yeah.
Pick it up here. It's a telegram from Western Union, of course, and it's very brief indeed. It's got here basically from Washington, D.C. on December 29th of, that would be, 43.
Yeah.
But now this last mission was in November of 43,
yeah.
right? It took that long for this telegram to come about.
Yeah.
So do you remember the date of your last mission, November of 43?
Oh, I sure don't. It was.
Oh, I was just wondering, because here it is today, 8 November. I was
yeah.
just wondering
it's pretty close to that.
We might be on the anniversary or pretty close to it.
It might be on that time, I think. 29th of November.
29th of November.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's an anniversary. You
yeah.
don't try and remember all that often. Well, anyways, the telegram is to, I believe, what, your dad here, Raymond
yeah.
E. Woodford, at... this would have gone to Oskaloosa, Iowa.
Oskaloosa, yeah.
Regret to inform you, your son, Staff Sergeant Charles A. Woodford, was on 29 November, oh,
yeah.
there's the date, seriously injured in action in the European area, period. You will be advised as reports of condition are received. Signed, Ulio, the Adjutant General. And it's just that short, just that brief, so... can only imagine the concern a parent would have of those words, seriously injured in action, and how you would fare with such grievous injuries. And well, we're happy to report that you managed quite well. And here you are at the age of, well, let me see.
You're 79?
You're going to be 79 here?
I'm 79 now. I'll be 80 next July.
Next July. Oh, right. I was just
yeah.
double-checking the birth date here. And
yeah.
Math is not my strong suit, but okay, yes. 79 and no dust gathering on you. Which, one thing I'm wondering about is, I'm just doing a quick time check. We're doing pretty good on time here. Do you see anything at all in the Hollywood films or books or documentaries that maybe have little or no mention, or maybe things that they didn't quite get right? Anything at all that you think should be pointed out to anyone who would want to know more about the air war over Europe?
Well, I think the best movie was this last one on Memphis Belle. That one that came out about 4 or 5 years ago. I think that was probably, my wife and I saw that, and I left the theater, and I mean, my shirt was wet. I mean, it was, it took you back about 50 years. Those that came out during the war, I think it, they just portrayed the glamour of the war, you know, and I don't think there's too much historic fact. You know, I wouldn't put too much hope on the historic fact on some of those.
But that Memphis Belle, that brought back you were there memories.
Yeah, that was a good one. That told it actually as it was.
Well, that's
12 O'Clock High was another good one, but
with Gregory Peck.
That was a good one. It, but those that came out, you know, in the 42s and 43s, you know, I guess they were all right, but you know, weren't that, as far as I'm concerned, that accurate.
Okay, well, certainly from a guy who was there, that's pretty good to learn what you endorse and what you say, you know, isn't maybe true to form, so to speak, or true to life. One thing I'm wondering about is then after your recovery, if you could just maybe sketch out the remainder of your military service, and then what you did post-war as far as a career where you lived and kind of the other life phases, you might say.
Well, I was in the hospital from the 29th of November until about April.
And that would have been April 44.
Yeah, 44. I came home on a hospital ship. I went to Walter Reed in Hot Springs, Arkansas. I got released. 30-day stay. Then went to Atlantic City for a reassignment. That's when I went down to Maxwell Field for cadet training. I got through my pre-flight training. I was at...
Now, cadet training as a...
Hopefully a pilot, but... I guess my scores and all that, they decided to send me to navigation school, Selman Field, Louisiana, and I enjoyed that. I was doing good, and of course, that's probably the low spot in my career. I'd gone through all my flying and training and all that stuff, and they checked my records, and didn't want to assign me back to a flight status because the chance of, something happening might be permanent injuries. So I went from there to San Antonio, Texas, then up to Lowry Field, Omaha, where I...
Well, let me just backtrack a second. I think you mentioned in one of our previous conversations that Navigator School, that you were, what, within about 2 weeks of graduation?
Yeah, about 2 weeks of graduation. I had my uniform ordered and everything like that, and announcements all printed, and then, boy, the bottom fell out.
That they wouldn't make an exception, even though you were so close to graduating, that they just... stood firm and said, no, we can't let you go on and become a navigator. You had some serious injuries, and we don't know if those might flare into something permanent.
Look back, I can see their point of view, because when I went through my training, you know, that was all low altitude. You know, that wasn't up in the temperatures, you know, where it was 40 degrees below zero and stuff like that. And but it was awfully hard to accept. I mean, that was probably the worst 3 or 4 day period of my whole career.
So you got out of the service then, well, you, after the navigator school, I just want to make sure, you then went
to San Antonio for reassignment and went up to Lowry Field, Denver on B-29s.
B-29 engine work.
Yeah. And that was great. Believe it or not, I hitchhiked home every weekend to Iowa from Denver to see my girlfriend, to see my wife, future wife.
Boy, well,
I had that down to a T. I mean, I knew going through Nebraska when the bus came, and if I wasn't in a car, I could catch that bus and ride to Council Bluffs. And I was never late for duty. I was always home on a Saturday morning for a late breakfast, and I left Sunday morning. And I never was late for duty, and never missed a day's work.
Where there's a will, there's a way, huh?
Boy, I must have, I knew I was in love. I mean, I just, well, anyway, I got out in October. I spent 3 years to the day, got out in 45, I went home.
Got out in October of 45.
October of 45, I went back to Iowa. Didn't do much until January, and I enrolled in college under the GI Bill. My wife and I were married in April of 1946. Been married ever since, and wonderful marriage. We went to college. I went to college on the GI Bill. Finished up to went out to Pennsylvania, Middletown, Pennsylvania, in civil service. We wanted to get back into the Midwest, so we applied for a transfer to Scott Air Force Base. Arrived at Scott in 1950.
Here in Illinois.
Yeah, in Illinois. Had a real good career. I retired in 1979.
Primarily doing what in civil service?
Well, I started out on the flight line, and then I went up into quality control, and I ended up in engineering. The good 3 years in budget and finance, and then the last 3 years was up in engineering. A great career. I mean, I look back on it, and I had a lot of good times. Retired, and we've just been busy. I mean, we've gotten involved with the Forest Service, doing volunteer work with the Forest Service. I think we've been out to Montana for 9 times, West Virginia a couple of times, Virginia once. We're active in the church, active in the high school sports program.
Here at the Union Methodist
Church,
where we are today.
Yeah, I've been in the choir, I've been 43 years in the choir.
I just want to make sure I say that one more time. Union United Methodist Church here in Illinois. Okay.
And I'm working part-time as Borders, Books, and Music, 20 hours a week, which I really enjoy.
Now, I remember, but aside from your very talented craftsmanship, that you also have a very impressive collection of stamps, which I believe is focused on helicopters.
Yes.
Is that right?
They have, what do they call it, inventory of whatever, and they say it's supposed to be the world's largest collection of stamps with helicopters.
And in fact, what, you get invited to various meetings, conferences,
right.
Because...
I've been invited back to Washington, D.C. 3 times to the American Helicopter Society annual forum. I was in Montreal 2 years ago. I'll be going back to Montreal this year to have them on display, and it's just a fantastic opportunity to meet a lot of great people.
Well, I'm sure... And will you continue to add to that collection as things come
available? Right now, there are probably about 50, I think there's 53 that I don't have that I'm aware of.
Well, I'm sure there's any number of places that would love to have that on display on a permanent basis if you ever feel like you would want to, however you might want to.
Well, the American Helicopter Museum in Westchester, Pennsylvania would like to have them.
Well, that sounds like an ideal place.
Yeah, and I'm working with an attorney, you know, as far as the details. I want to be sure, you know, if I decide to go that way, that they're protected, they're taken care of. And because, nobody around Belleville is really too excited about helicopter stamps. You know, the only time I get to put them on display is at a worldwide convention.
Well, that's quite a feather in your cap to have something that unique that is certainly prized by the aviation community, and myself included. Mm-hmm. Well, something else I'd appreciate your insights about is, of course, you are a part of what's been termed the greatest generation. Tom Brokaw's book, basically, as I understand it, generation that had the trials of the Great Depression and fighting tyranny in World War II and banding together to not only defeat the tyranny, but to then build a very prosperous America that many people should be so thankful for today and not take for granted. I'd be interested to hear your views of, in your own words, what you see as the contribution you made and to maybe also what you would describe as the contribution of your generation to America today and for future generations.
Well, I believe in a good, strong work ethic. I think if somebody hires me, I mean, I owe to them to give them the best of I have. I know my dad always told me if I'm going to attempt a job, do it the best I can or don't try. I'd be honest, you know, we came through some rough times, but we didn't know we were poor. Everybody was in the same situation. We had a good childhood. I had strong parents, and we've tried to bring up our son and daughter in the same values that we were raised. We were, I think we were just the average people that believed in the country. We got active, we volunteered, and civic groups, church groups, and did what we could, you know, to maybe make our little old community maybe a little bit better place than it was, you know, before we came on board. But I think a lot of it goes back to the strength that our parents and my wife's parents, you know, instilled on us, you know, when we were growing up and going through grade school and high school.
Very good. I would be interested to hear, of course, we're about 2 months here in after the fact of those very horrific attacks on 11 September by terrorists, World Trade Center, and slamming jets there, as well as a jet into the Pentagon, and another jet that apparently the passengers on board that were in fighting for control went down in Pennsylvania. And of course, you were alive to also witness the awful events of Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about how you see those two events? Well, first of all, how you heard the news for Pearl Harbor and then the 11th September, and how you see those very significant events in American history.
Well, Pearl Harbor, I didn't realize that had been bombed. I was out in California flying sailplanes. We came back into Glendale that evening and we'd heard about it. And it really bothered me, you know, it really upset me that somebody could do that. You know, it was so unexpected. At that point in time, I didn't think, you know, it was supposed to happen. The World Trade Center, I looked at that television and I just couldn't believe, you know, what I was witnessing. I just couldn't imagine how anybody could have such hatred towards anybody or anything to do what they did and to take so many innocent lives. And I just, you know, I still can't. I can't comprehend that. My wife and I think we're looking over our shoulder now. We go into a restaurant. I think we're a little suspicious, you know, if we see somebody of a different color. We're more cautious, we're more aware, and I still can't understand how anybody can be brainwashed in that type of a lifestyle. And know that you work for 4 years and eventually just so you can commit suicide.
Yeah, well, I certainly share a lot of those sentiments. It's of course, I can't speak to how, you know, how I took the news at Pearl Harbor, of course, but just kind of, this is a minor point, but you said you were flying sailplanes when you mean gliders?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was working for, you know, I went over and helped up one of the instructors at school I was going to on constructing sailplanes. He designed and built his own, and so for to pay me while we would, you know, he let me go out and show me how to, you know, give me instructions on sailplane flying. And
Okay.
That's where I was the day of Pearl Harbor.
I see. You came back and heard the news on the radio?
Yeah, I heard it on the radio.
On the radio. Yeah. Well, you know, I'd say we're coming down on the last few minutes of tape here, and so I guess this would be probably a good opportunity to ask you if there's anything else you would like to add, maybe anything we didn't address or issues that you think someone who has an interest in the air war in Europe or any other topics that we've discussed or maybe haven't discussed that you would like to add to this oral history session?
Well, I didn't realize until about the last 8 or 9 years how expendable we were in combat. And that bothered me. I read a book not too long ago that the 8th Air Force was nothing but decoy, you know, to get the fighters up. You know, from what you read, the destruction we did wasn't all that great. And that really bothered me because a lot of innocent people went to their death on that. I mean, we were believing, you know, that we were really contributing to the war effort and then have it come out, that we were using as decoys and stuff like that. You know, that has really bothered me.
Now, you mentioned you read a book. What book?
I don't know which one it was. It was... I've got it at home, but it really bothered me that it was quite a thick book, that it was a history of the air war in Europe. And basically what this author's point of view was that we were flying to get the Luftwaffe up, you know, so we could take care of them.
Do you remember the name of the author?
I can sure get it, yeah, I just, of course, I don't know what it is now. But, you know, they told us after the Schweinfurt raid that we shortened the war effort, I don't know by how many months, and about 60 days later, they were back to doggone near full production. You know, we got a citation and everything like that, so, you know, at that time, you didn't think about it, but you look at it now, you know, you just wonder. But we never questioned any of these decisions, you know. We did what we were told, and no griping or anything like that.
No. Well, for my two cents, I have heard some of that sentiment that the 8th Air Force and other bomber units helped to draw the Luftwaffe into combat to help, hopefully, through increasing attrition, win air superiority, although... you know, I for one would not say you were simply a glorified decoy of sorts, and that it's the debate still rages today through assessments and to what extent, you know, the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey that assigning certain measures of credit to this or that factor for helping to win the war, and that will continue to be a source of debate and very difficult to be absolutely definitive about who did what and to what extent when there were so many involved. But of course, this isn't my oral history interview, it's yours.
Well,
I just wasn't sure if there's
anything
else.
Yeah, there's
else
so many books
to,
coming out now, you know, you really don't know what to believe. I mean, I still believe, I want to believe that we contributed to the war effort. I mean, I feel we did, and the major success, I don't know, but I think we did what we were asked to do, and we did it the best way we could. And nobody can take that thought away from me, regardless of what they write. And we had a lot of good men, and it was a great time. I don't know, I qualify that great. It was a time I would not want to go over through again, but I'm very...